This episode is brought to you by Audible.com. As you know, Audible is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks and a lot more. This time, I would like to recommend Jeff Shara's first novel in his World War II series, The Rising Tide. What's great about this book is its intimate level when dealing with all the well-known but also more obscure characters. The research is amazing and the writing is fantastic. But honestly, the reader takes all this to another level. His ability with voices and accents is first class. The book covers Hitler's string of victories, as well as explaining how the U.S. was drawn into the war. Then the book slows down as the Americans learn the hard way about fighting in this modern war. Now, I haven't recommended this book before, even though I've listened to it twice, because for the longest time it was a two-credit book. You don't really need to know what that means, but what it comes down to is you couldn't have got it for free when you signed up for a free 30-day trial. But now that some time has passed and he's come out with other books in the series, you can. So check it out. I think you'll like it a lot. Or if you want to, you can check out one of his other books in the series. Also, he's done books on World War I and the Civil War. And trust me, all of his writing is amazing. The research is very detailed, and he always gets good readers for his books. So I think you'll like it a lot. Hello, and thank you for joining us for another Talk History episode. This time today, we have Stephen Guerra with us from the History of the Papacy podcast. It's something new that he's launched. I hope you all check it out. I think you'll enjoy it a lot. Stephen, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Glad to be on.
Thank you very much for joining us. So I have to be honest with you. I came very close to starting my own. I was just going to be lame and call it the History of the Popes podcast. I like your title better. So I borrowed a whole bunch of books from my brother-in-law, who's a priest. Now I have to ship them all back. But when you told me you were going to do your podcast, I got excited because now I can listen to them all and I don't have to do any of the work. So I think that's great. So I just want to thank you for being with us. So what made you decide to enjoy the hurt and pain of doing a podcast?
You know, I thought I've been listening to these podcasts all the time and I just wanted to jump in. It's been so much fun doing all this research, and that actually people want to listen to it. That's just a bonus on top of it all.
Yeah, I think we met through the History podcast page on Facebook. Isn't that right? Yeah. And I think we were talking back and forth, and you told us you were going to do one. You just had to come up with the subject matter. So what made you decide on the history of the papacy?
Yeah, it's so wide open. There's so many different avenues you can take. And I figured I don't really have to go from the first pope to Benedict the 16th. I can stop along the way, take some sidetracks. And so then it'll keep, you know, with my ADD personality, it can keep me interested for many years to come.
There you go. So if you're interested, everybody else should be interested as well. So it's kind of like what Laszlo Montgomery of the China History podcast does. He just kind of jumps around, you know, what interests me at this point. And, you know, you've got thousands of years to just kind of jump around. I think that's really neat. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully, you know, so themes develop and be able to take it in whatever direction it goes in.
Yeah, you're almost doing the history of, I guess, Central Europe, or I guess the history of Europe for the last 2,000 years. So, yeah, like you said, it's wide open. And I encourage you to explore that because there are people that have podcasts and they kind of go off on tangents. And that's okay because if it's something we don't know, we enjoy learning it. And that's the whole point of, you know, listening to a podcast in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so you've listened to the last couple of episodes. What would you like to talk about or delve further into?
Well, I didn't know much about the history of Greece and the war. I think most of what you learn about is when the Germans came in. What would it be, about a year later, give or take?
Actually, I think it's March or April of 41 when they come in. Mussolini is pretty much backed up to the wall. Hitler can't let this stand, so he's got to jump in. And when the Germans come in, it's over with pretty quickly. But, that's going to happen in the future. But Mussolini, Italy just wasn't ready for this, and they just jumped into it. And they've already had to worry about the British in North Africa and in the Mediterranean. And then just trying to keep up with Hitler, almost like a spitting contest. He decides to invade Greece and really pays the price for it.
Yeah, I was just thinking to myself, listening to it, it's like, what a mess they got themselves into. It's just like one thing after another. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I haven't done this yet, but I was thinking the other day when I was trying to get ready for this show, and if you sit back and think about it, it's pretty amazing. Mussolini comes to power in 1922. He's the big man on stage, the big man on campus. He's flamboyant. He's a little dangerous. He's a little sexy. You know, he's like the Rolling Stones of Europe compared to the Beatles. And he sits out the war in Poland. He finally jumps in when France is all but beaten. And if you think about it, it pretty much goes like this. He tries to take some of southern France. His men get their butt kicked. And then he goes into the Mediterranean, and Admiral Cunningham hands him two decisive defeats early in the summer, and then Graziani invades Egypt, only goes 60 miles and stops, and then you have his war in Greece, which is going to end up horrible. He's going to push the men. I think the Greeks are going to push the men all the way back almost to the Adriatic coast. Then you've got Taranto, the defeat. Then you've got the British pushing his men back in North Africa. So he went from this rock star to a matter of months to almost every front he had was just pushed back on. And he just couldn't have been more sad. And there's no number of mistresses that are going to make you feel better after all that has happened to you.
And it just seems to me like there was no real point to it all besides, you know, that whole Mare Nostrum idea that it's like big deal. The Greece didn't really do anything for them. It was just, it seemed more of an idea than that there was any real economic boon or more resources or something like that.
Exactly. They spent more money and lost, you know, more resources and men trying to take it than what they ever got out of it. And I think I'm going to cover this right after the Battle of Taranto, or should I say the attack of Taranto. Mussolini is going to turn to his son-in-law Ciano and go, you know, maybe I should get Hitler to intervene, act as the middle guy, and maybe we can talk out a peace plan with Greece. And Ciano's like, yeah, you really don't want to do that because you would just lose huge face. You can't do that, and you've got your partner Hitler, who's, let's be honest, he's the senior partner, and there's no way he's going to go for that. So he was in such depths of despair. He thought about, you know, coming up with a peace plan with Greece, but there was no way that Hitler was going to let that happen.
Yeah, it's and then just the whole thing with Britain, because you got to get yourself in the mindset that Britain was completely on their own at that point. And you're thinking like, man, why don't they just help them out a little bit here? But they couldn't.
Yeah, they were so between what happened in Norway, what happened in Dunkirk, and what happened when France fall. The British are tough, and they're going to stay in the war. But you got to admit, I mean, they've taken some serious body blows, and they have the mentality that, well, we would love to pour resources into Greece, but we, just like everyone else, think this is going to be over within 2 or 3 weeks, as in Greece is going to be run over. You know, if they had a crystal ball and they could have seen what was going to happen, yeah, they would have poured a lot more. But just like everyone else, they're like, this is just going to be another quick access victory, and there's no point in throwing the money away. But obviously, Metexas and the Greek warriors had a lot. They were going to show the world, and for a while they did.
I mean, they had the time to set up. I mean, that was another mistake, is you don't give even somebody you think you're going to roll over that much time.
Yeah, yeah. Hitler was obsessed with keeping the East calm because he didn't want Stalin, who was already suspicious and paranoid, to be any more suspicious and paranoid. He wanted it calm so he could go in there and do like a sucker punch body blow. And here's Mussolini making it quite clear that one day I will attack Greece. Greece's leader is a military expert who's trained in Germany, you know, back in World War One, and you don't give someone with that kind of experience and knowledge, and because it was more or less a dictatorship, that kind of control, you don't give him that much time to prepare, even though they don't have a lot of resources or money or the amazing air force that Italy had. He's going to try and defend his country somehow, and they should have taken that into account, and they didn't, and it was just... it was crazy. It makes no military sense whatsoever.
And who in Bulgaria, who are they allied to at that point?
Well, the funny thing was, if Mussolini had gone to Hitler and he said, okay, I want to take Greece, and I don't really want your help as in military troops, but I want your political influence, the Bulgarians would have given in to Hitler and helped attack Greece. But Mussolini, to be quite blunt, on his own, didn't have the political and military clout to intimidate Bulgaria enough to actually step into this. But at the same time, Bulgaria had to keep their eye on Yugoslavia and Turkey, which we haven't gotten into yet. We'll get into that. But if he had just asked for Hitler's assistance, at least politically, you know, Bulgaria would have come in and it could have been a very different war. But he didn't, because, I don't know, arrogance, or probably more like military naivete. And his men pay the price for it.
Well, I think, Mussolini, he was in power for a long time at that point.
Yeah, since 1922.
And people, you know, even in America, for about a long time, people thought that he was, you know, he was running the model state and everything. So, I mean, that could get to your head.
Absolutely. I mean, he was already in love with himself early on. But when he actually became the leader of Italy, he was going to, I mean, it just fueled that, I don't know if you want to call it ego or whatever, it just fueled it all the more. And if you believe in that, if you're his enemy and you believe in that, you're going to cower before the fight starts. And Greece just didn't fall for that. They were going to resist, and they came up with a plan, and for a while it worked.
And then Metaxas was something else. That was really, that was interesting. You know, I had no idea. That's something you don't learn about either. Yeah. Do you have any perception on how he's thought of in Greece today? Is he like a national hero? Or
no, I think from what I've read, and I could be wrong, and if anyone's listening to this, please send me an email. I don't think there are statues of him all over the place, but now they do celebrate, like I said in one of the podcasts, they do celebrate on October 28th when he says no. But what they celebrate is Greece standing up to Italy. It's like the national no day. So Metaxas, you would think, would be a hero, but at the same time, you have to remember he was a dictator. He had a very effective secret police. They kept their opposition suppressed rather harshly. So he did what he needed to do. And a lot of the Greeks said, I hate his guts and I wish I could shoot him in the head, but he's a heck of a fighter. And since we're on the same side against the Italians, I'll join the fight. But that doesn't mean I love him. I don't think he's a folk hero in Greece, but I think they celebrate their desire to keep their freedom in whatever form that they had it in 1940.
Yeah, that's really it. I mean, that's interesting. And then, you know, the thing that never comes up too much is about Romania either. How, you know, that was the oil central. That was more important for oil production than the Middle East was.
Yeah, as far as the Axis were concerned, they needed the Ploiesti oil fields, and they needed to keep it out of Stalin's hands. And so, basically, Romania was sacrificed. Hitler sacrificed them for a lot of different reasons to a lot of different countries. But he was going to make sure that he held on to the oil no matter what. And you made a pretty good point earlier when you said that most people think about Greece and they think about the Germans coming in April. I think it was April of 41. But yeah, I had to do some serious digging to find some books on this. And one of the listeners, a professor, Mike, he just calls himself Professor Mike. He has a PhD. He gave me a list of books and he sent me some copies of some original documents. And if it wasn't for him, I would have struggled trying to find this material. But yeah, it's a very interesting thing. And I was literally learning as I was going along.
Is there anything else that you learned in there that didn't make the podcast that was interesting or,
Yeah, there's a lot of little things. The people, like I said, the people weren't very happy with him, but it was almost like after Pearl Harbor here, the people who hated Roosevelt, and the whole isolationist thing, the second we're attacked, we're together. We have a common enemy. Metaxas had no more or very little trouble after the Italians attack. Everybody's on his side. Yeah, I hate him, but we're on the same side. And he knew what he was doing. And the secret police didn't have to work so hard suppressing the people. They certainly kept their foot on the throats of the communists. But overall, the people were like, okay, we're going to do this. Like I said, women and children were given over their pack animals to the soldiers. And they were just, you know, even though they needed these things to live, they were just giving up whatever food or foodstuffs or just clothes and their pack animals to the soldiers. Okay, go defend us. Go fight. And for a while, they were all together as much as any country could be.
Yeah, you really see why Greece might have a chip on their shoulder. You know, they thought that Germany was in their corner that whole time. I mean, is that what that seemed to be what was going on, is that they thought that Germany was going to go to bat for them?
Yeah, that part, I'm not sure I fully understand it, but there was a certain segment, and just like any country, you know, there are Americans who live in other countries. There were Greeks who lived in Germany and worked in Berlin, and they convinced themselves. I don't think the Germans did anything to help them. I think they just convinced themselves that there's no way Hitler's going to let this happen. Well, guess what? To a certain degree, Hitler didn't know it was going to happen until it was too late. But I think they were just afraid. And sometimes when people get afraid, certainly collectively, they're able to justify anything. And they're like, oh, Hitler's not going to let this happen. There's no way. And so they held on to that because literally they had nothing else. They, just like everyone else, thought if Italy attacks us, this is going to be over within days, and we're just going to be another occupied territory added to the, added to Mussolini's belt.
I wonder what would have happened if Italy had won, if they did swoop in.
Yeah, if they had swooped in and won, Mussolini would have shouted it from the mountaintops, and he would have celebrated. I'm sure he would have given himself some more awards and promoted some more generals, and then he would have probably been emboldened to go after other countries. But after this, Hitler's going to have to save him, and then Hitler's pretty much calling the shots, and the Germans are going to be pretty much giving directives. Okay, you can do this, but don't go too far with this. In the Mediterranean, do this, but don't go too far. You know, that kind of thing. So after Hitler saves him, Hitler's truly in the driver's seat. He is already, but Mussolini doesn't know that or doesn't want to believe that.
Yeah, probably after that point, Mussolini's smoking cigars and...
Yeah.
Yeah, hanging out.
Yeah, he was in his own little world. But what's amazing is, I guess it's his ego. He's gonna bounce back from this. As humiliating as this is, he's gonna bounce back, and he still thinks, just like a lot of other people think, that Italy might not end up ruling Europe, but Germany is. And if we're their partner, I'd rather be a junior partner on the winning side than the leader on the losing side. So he's going to a certain degree, bounce back. But in Italy, it's all going to start to fall apart. The people really didn't hate the Italian people. They just want to live their lives. They don't hate all these other countries. They saw the pact with between Italy and Germany as really between Mussolini and Hitler, and they didn't want any part of it. They're like, okay, if you want to be his partner, that's fine, but leave me alone. I'm a person. I live in the mountains, or I live in the countryside, and I have my life, and I'm doing my thing. Don't involve me. So the Italians didn't really see it that way, but Mussolini was able to get enough of the men together to form his armies, to do his thing. But it's going to fall apart really quickly because, you know, and by the time 43 comes, Italy is officially out of the war, and you know, America's the Allied troops are sort of starting to come up. So when it falls apart, it's going to fall apart pretty fast.
Where was Mussolini's power base? Was it in the north?
Oh my God, I used to know the answer to this. Let's see here. As far as the countryside, the rural side, he really didn't have a lot of influence. I mean, this is going to be hard to believe, but there were people in Italy who the war did almost not affect them. I mean, they lived their lives and they grew their crops or whatever, you know, they were growing or animals or whatever. And a lot of them were almost untouched by the war, except for maybe some of the bombing or when the troops came in. But there was a certain segment, the more cosmopolitan, the cities, the societies around cities were his power base. But a lot of people just didn't care, and they just wanted to live their life and not be bothered. And, you know, in a lot of ways, America was going to be like that. There's, you know, America's just so vast. There was a lot of people who were just living their lives, and, you know, it didn't touch them. And it's the same thing in Italy.
Yeah, Spain is that way.
Mm-hmm. That's the big question. If Mussolini hadn't lost his prestige in the Greek War, could he have talked Franco into doing something more? Or maybe even got the Vichy French to give their Navy over to the Axis. You just never know. But after this, it's over for Mussolini. He's just going to be the junior partner and do whatever he's told. And he'll bitch about it, but he'll do it and go on with his life because, hey, he has no choice.
Where are you going with the next?
I'm going to cover the what I'm trying to do. And I almost wish I could come out with the episodes really fast, like the way it happened, because if you think about it, Italy attacks Greece, they get pushed back, then Taranto, the Battle of Taranto, where they lose all these ships, they're going to be out of commission for months. And then right after that, the Greeks push the Italians back into Albania, almost into the sea, then the Germans come in. And so for him, it's just one bad thing after another. And so the Germans come in, they take over Greece pretty quickly, which is even more embarrassing for Mussolini. So I'll probably cover that for a while. But then you got to remember in December, is it December 9th? December, that's when the British push in North Africa, and they push for hundreds of miles, I think, back into Tripoli. So it's only going to get worse for Mussolini. But I guess I wish I could convey how fast and how bad it gets for Italy and Mussolini on a personal level when everything that he touches just goes wrong and just looks so bad so quickly. I won't be able to really convey that because it's going to take, you know, weeks and weeks for all these episodes to come out, but I'm going to try and just show how fast everything just falls apart everywhere. And oh my God, what do you do?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what a way to go out.
Yeah. And then he's hacked yeah, to pieces by his own people. I've seen photos on the internet, which I don't know if I'll put them on the website. They're pretty gruesome, but I mean, his people literally tear him apart. So he goes from the great man to being a junior partner to being ripped apart by his own people. I mean, that's a story right there. That's just amazing.
20 odd years in power, and that's how you end.
And all, I mean, that's it. Yeah.
It's like Nero or something.
Yeah, just stretched out.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real part of the war you don't hear about enough.
Yeah, he gets... It's not really fair because in some ways he was politically shrewd. He was adept. He just... He kind of did what Stalin did before the war. He picked people who were loyal or sycophants as opposed to their military prowess or their ability or their organizational skills or whatever. He had yes men around him when he should have had professionals around him. There were professionals in different positions when he first came to power, but over time they get weeded out. And so he's got all these men who are very loyal, or at least to his face, but they're not very competent. And so there's just a huge... almost countrywide breakdown in talent, and they're going to pay the price for it.
Yeah, all that nationalism too. I mean, it's, you know, instead of making a smart military move, what's going to make us look better?
Exactly. I think one of the things that's hard for us to grasp nowadays, and to be honest with you, I occasionally forget it, and I have to remind myself, it was almost like our army is going to beat your army because our system of government is fascist, and fascist is superior to democracy. So we're going to have a better system. We're going to have better warriors. And so when we win this war, it's because fascism is better than democracy or parliamentary, you know, whatever the system of government is. But they took that, I guess I should say Mussolini and Hitler, they took that very seriously. I mean, that stuff came out of their mouths, and you never know how much they believed it, but it was literally to them a type of government versus a type of government. And nowadays, it's hard for us to imagine that. We're like, what are you talking about? Because we already know what's going to happen. But for them, it was like the fascists are invulnerable. Up until this point, they had not really put a foot wrong. And everybody assumed they were going to win in Greece because they had won everywhere else. It didn't matter if it was Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. Because of their system of government, because of the way they could control and organize the resources of that state, they were going to win. And Hitler, one of the things that frustrated Hitler was, I'm trying to negotiate with all these countries. I'm trying to keep Stalin pacified and subdued over there. And here you are, you're blowing the mystique of fascism. Everything, we seemed unstoppable up until this point, and because of you, I got to go in there and fix it now. But yeah, that really was a real element politically and militarily throughout Europe.
And it just seemed, you had a matter of logistics, too. I think that they were so obsessed with the cool uniforms and cool weapons and stuff like that, and they never thought that stuff out, which would probably is what will be their downfall not too many years later.
Yeah, there was a German military attaché sent to North Africa before the British come in, I think on December 9th, and he says, if we send troops here, if we send tanks here, if we send anything here, they're not going to be resupplied because the organization behind the main lines that Italy uses is so flawed that you can't count on regular resources. And we all know that even though it's not sexy, wars are won because of good organization behind the lines. You're going to get your reinforcements. You're going to get your ammo. You're going to get your food. You're going to be able to take care of your sick and your wounded. That's what wins. Wins wars. It's not sexy, but it's true. And the Italians ignored that. The Germans were obsessed with it to a certain degree and up to a certain point. And they just fared a lot better until it all started breaking down for them.
Yeah, they just never had enough stuff.
Yeah.
Boots, like you said, that one, where was it, where a thing of blankets burned down or something?
Yeah, there was a huge storage in Athens, and it caught on fire, and no one knows, was it the communists, on orders from Moscow or whatever, or was it just a bizarre accident? But the Greeks literally lost 200,000 blankets as winter's coming on, and they could have really used them. But even though their boots, which weren't the best made, are starting to fall apart as they trudge through the mountains, they're still kicking the crap out of the Italians without enough blankets, without proper shoes, because they're pissed off, they're angry, they feel cheated, they've done everything they could to stay out of the war, and they get invaded anyway. And it just really made them angry, and they took it personally as a country, and they just fought back with a tenacity that had nothing to do with boots or blankets. They were just going to... they felt violated, and they were going to fight back.
I don't know if maybe this is somewhat controversial. I almost wonder with World War II, it's so much of the big battles, Kursk and D-Day. But think about all these, these big machines like the German army. They really got worn down by the guerrilla movements and the asymmetrical warfare. Yeah, you have the Dutch resistance and the French resistance. A lot of Poland, where it was all behind the line stuff, where the Germans, they couldn't rest in the rear because you had, they could get bombed. It's kind of, I don't know if we want to go here or not with what might be happening in Afghanistan to us and at Russia. You have these military machines that can, they crush conventional forces, but it's really hard to deal with the unconventional. I thought a lot about that. How do you deal with them?
Yeah, over time, it's almost like a cycle. Over time, as the Axis does worse in their battles, the people feel emboldened, and so they start to resist in little ways and sometimes not little ways. And the Germans and the Italians have to spend so much time and resources and manpower suppressing what they should have already conquered that they can't send those extra resources and men to the front lines to deal with the current battle. And yeah, that's going to happen a lot. I think it was in Denmark for the first couple of years. I mean, the Germans were pretty nice because they really didn't have a reason to suppress, except for the Jewish population. But after a while, everybody starts resisting, and they have to spend so much time and resources that it's going to affect the overall war, and they kind of did it to themselves. And the reason they were being cruel and suppressing is because their ideology, we're humans, you're subhumans, you deserve to be treated this way, and we're going to exploit you up until you die, and they suffered for that philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think the Nazis really had the soft touch in them,
yeah.
But what do? If you crush them, you kill my brother who was in the resistance. Well, maybe I really didn't care about the resistance so much. I want to get along but then you just killed my brother. Maybe I should join the resistance now.
Yeah, it got very personal very quickly, especially in countries like France with the French resistance. And, of course, Britain was doing everything they could to help them and encourage them. But, it got ugly very quickly. And then even after the war, which I hope to go into, people had to live with what either they did or didn't do during the war. And in some ways, you have to... this sounds cruel, but you almost have to wait for a generation or two to pass away before it's not personal anymore, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what a mess.
Yeah.
I mean, that stuff, I mean, those wounds like that are probably still open over there.
Yeah, you got to think of all the trouble that Greece is having now economically, and Germany is an economic powerhouse. I mean, you think that's got to touch some sore spots, but I'm certainly not an expert in that, and I'll leave that to someone else to analyze.
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows how many Greek listeners are out there, but you might be touching a live wire there.
Yeah. Well, they should be proud of what they did. I mean, with considering what they didn't have compared to what the Italians had, they did an amazing thing. And again, it's almost like the British, if they had waited until Hitler attacked the Soviet Union and then went after Italy, Hitler would have been caught up in the war against Russia, and he wouldn't have been able to do too much about it. It's almost like if the Greeks hadn't, same thing with the Greeks, if they hadn't pushed back so hard and so quickly and so successfully, maybe wait. And of course, they don't know that Hitler's going to go after Stalin in Russia. But once Germany is committed to the east, I mean, that's when things really open up, because he's got to send all his resources to deal with that vast territory. But that's the way the timing worked out, and they just had to do the best they could.
And then what's coming up, the Germans wind up trying to attack Crete, because Crete was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, the British were obsessed with that just because it was just too darn close to the Suez. That had to be kept safe. So they sent troops there. So the 5th Division, the 5th Greek Division on Crete, can go help fight on the mainland. Well, that's fine. But that's, and this is a whole long story, but the short version is Hitler is talked into an airborne assault by the commander of the airborne troops. So they do that. They lose a lot of men, but it works. And then the British have to leave Crete. And again, it's just part of that overall, you know, can the Germans lose? This is just amazing. They just beat us everywhere. But as we all know now, Hitler started preparing for war when he came to power in 1933. And they just had, you know, years and years of a head start to get their men ready, build up enough tanks and planes and equipment and arms and all that kind of stuff. So they had a huge head start. They made the most of it. But then, and you can argue this all day long, but then Hitler goes too far by trying to take out the Soviet Union before Britain is finished. And he just made a mistake, and he overreached and paid the price for it.
It never made sense to me why. I mean, I guess he was so antagonistic to Britain. He tried, but, you know, he tried to be, it seemed like his, any of the peace he tried to do was kind of half-hearted. You know, again, peace wasn't really in his agenda.
Yeah, he just wanted them to acknowledge his mastery of Europe. Okay, you get to keep your empire, Britain. Europe is mine. And just acknowledge that. And it drove him crazy that Churchill and the British would not do that. But when it came to Russia, it was personal. He hated fascism. I mean, excuse me, he hated communism. He hated Stalin. And it was visceral. It was personal. And it wasn't just a political military decision. This is my next opponent. He wanted to wipe them out, the Slavic race. He hated Stalin. He hated communism. And it was personal. So once he commits to it, he's going to throw everything he possibly can at it. And Rommel in North Africa is going to pay the ultimate price for that.
Yeah, I mean, that was just murder.
Yeah.
In the East.
When the Germans first go into Soviet Union, the people there are thinking, oh, these are my liberators. Well, they didn't, you know, they could have played it smart. They could have treated the people well and got them to help fight. But no, the people, because they were Slavic or whatever, they were the actual enemy too. So they were going to be treated badly. They were going to be murdered. They were going to be used as slave labor and then killed off. He wanted the entire country depopulated so they can move Germans into it, because they needed the Ukraine for all its wheat and stuff like that. But again, he misstepped there too. Thank goodness.
I mean, it's such a monstrous policy just on the surface. But then I wonder if Germany really did have such an excess population that, you know, that they really could have made something of these vast territories. You know, the Ukraine, it's massive.
Yeah, not really. One, he just wanted to deny Russians their own food, but also, you know, the mothers in Germany were encouraged to have a lot of children, and they got, I don't remember the exact the exact words, but they were given little medals and status if they had more children, if they had more boys. So they might not have needed the land right now, but they would have needed it according to Hitler's plan. You know, a decade or two or whatever down the road, but it was mostly to get it away from the Russians and have them all starve to death and be defeated. Yeah, it was personal. It was personal.
Yeah, that's very personal. Yeah. Because if he would have, I mean, if he would have played it smart, kept Russia out of the game for another year,
yeah,
who knows what could have happened.
Well, the very thing that made him an effective leader was also his downfall, because he... You know, he pushed everybody in the country. I mean, he pushed his military leaders. But that same thing, that tenacity, made him overreach. And that's just kind of the way it went. Well, I appreciate you being with us. Again, I'm looking forward to your podcast. And I'm a little bit, you know, jealous that you beat me to the punch. But I'm looking forward to listening. And again, I hope you have fun with it. And I hope you learn a lot, because... That's mostly why we're doing this, I think. And I think the listeners will appreciate your enthusiasm, because you're learning along with them.
No, thanks a lot for having me on.
Sure.
Anybody who wants to find the page, you can find the podcast at Facebook, at the History of the Papacy Podcast Facebook page.
And what's the website?
The website is a2zhistory@libsyn.com. So it's A-T-O-Z history page at libsyn.com, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And you can also email me at a2zhistorypage@gmail.com. If there's something you want to learn more about, or say, hey, you got it all wrong, I'd love to hear from you one way or the other. Yeah, I'll back up somewhere short of the Big Bang, probably.
There you go. You got it covered.
Yeah.
You're going to be doing this as long as I am, so great. I don't want to be alone.
Full steam ahead. You know what? There needs to be another History Cage match.
Yeah, I think we're all – this is kind of funny. I think we're all so – we're friendly, but we're competitive. We're spending so much time and energy trying to get out the next episode to be higher ranked on iTunes. We don't have the time or the energy to actually get together and be nice to each other. But hopefully there'll be another one. And now that you're a fellow podcaster, obviously I'd like to see you in there, as long as we're on the same side. And I think it could be a lot of fun. So I just want to thank you for being on and spending time with us. Good luck with the podcast. And I've already subscribed, and I'll certainly be listening. And as one of your fellow podcasters, anything I can ever do to help, I would be glad to.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a blast, and hopefully we can do this again sometime in the future.
So, everybody, thank you for listening. Episode 70 will be out soon, the Battle of Taranto. And hopefully within a week or two, Stephen's next episode will be out. And please check out his podcast and help him out all you can. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And as always, take care.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.